as it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
So Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education, like a lot of the cabinet positions that the Donald has filled, folks who don't believe in what it is that they're in charge of doing. And again, you know, Betsy DeVos, an interesting kind of character to be leading the institution in charge of public education. Someone who has worked her entire life as a lobbyist. Well, first, birth lottery winner. Billionaire, and then lobbyist for privatized education. Now going to be in charge of all of the levers of power to make our public schools better. Is that really going to happen? And for me, again, having this conversation of, is privatization the way we should be going? Is education better in the hands of the profiteers? I don't think so, but here to talk about and share some of his thoughts, I've asked Samuel Abrams. He's the director of Columbia University's National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education. He's also written a new book called Education and the Commercial Mindset. Samuel, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
So this is really an excellent opportunity to kind of look back over the last 30 years of moving towards privatized education, first with charters, then the talk of vouchers and all of these other silver bullet kind of schemes to make our children learn, I guess. That's kind of the goal, right?
That's the goal. And to give parents choice for cultural interests that appeal.
Is choice a big part of this? Because I got to be honest, when I hear the choice buzzword, I start thinking about, well, I think about myself growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We didn't have a lot of choice in a lot of things. And a poorly funded public school or a poorly funded charter school, I don't know. I'm kind of confused on that.
Well, that's an excellent point. There's not much choice if the new options are poorly funded, as you pointed out. The hope had been from the outset in 1955 with Milton Friedman's famous essay, The Role of Government in Education, that choice would generate the competition between schools to consequently improve. Friedman thought it would also be a ticket for children in segregated neighborhoods out of those neighborhoods. Moreover, he thought that he expressed in this essay in 1955 that competition between schools would also mean a increase in salary for teachers because these schools would be competing for the services of better teachers. None of this came to be. We've seen more segregation on account of charter schools. This is not restricted to the United States. It's happened in a number of other countries. Sweden is a good example. The Netherlands is another good example. The Netherlands has a full voucher system, and you do have parents there enrolling their students, their children, in church schools, Catholic or Protestant, not because of doctrinal belief, but because they can be sure that Muslim children aren't going to be at those schools. So, and as far as increasing teacher pay, that hasn't happened in Sweden, it hasn't happened in Chile, it hasn't happened in the United States on account of competition for the services of teachers.
Right. Because when I hear competition, to be honest, when you hear people talk about this love affair with competition, be it healthcare, be it education, be it anything that used to be part of the commons, to me, it's all about destroying wages and conditions. It's all about lessening services and, well, maximizing profit.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be about profit. And the expectation on Wall Street 20 years ago was that by 2010, 10 to 20% of America's public schools, we have about 100,000 public schools, would be run by for-profit firms. Wall Street was terribly wrong about that. By 2010, it would be about 750 schools, so under 1%. We're at about that right now, about 750 schools run for profit. Now, you do have nonprofit charter schools, and we have about nearly 7,000 charter schools across the country now.
Right.
Most of them, about 90% of them are run nonprofit. There is an opportunity there for self-dealing. That's been documented. We have self-dealing in conventional public schools, too. There's room for corruption everywhere. I don't think privatization necessarily means profit. It can mean that, and it certainly can mean it in the way of self-dealing. The way some of the self-dealing happens in the nonprofit world is you have charter networks that establish real estate and investment trusts and then rent property for themselves at inflated rates.
We see that all over Pennsylvania.
That's been documented.
Right, yeah, we see that all over Pennsylvania. Also, all of the ancillary things that need to be done in the school are done by, you know, friends of friends or whatever.
Right.
And also the curriculum. I mean, to me, the part of charter schools that I actually liked was we were going to try different things and best practices we would share. Sharing didn't really happen, in my view. It was sold, so we funded the development of all of this new great curriculum that we then had to after funding its development, had to then buy back.
It, in a formal sense, that can happen. To the credit of a number of charter school networks, they have developed different philosophies for educating students, and that can be replicated in public schools. Certainly public schools can learn from charter schools. Ironically, it was Albert Shanker back in 1988 who came up with the idea of charter schools.
Correct.
He didn't think they were going to become what they became, but he just saw them as laboratories for different ways of doing things, and they could rub off on public schools in general in a positive way.
And Albert Shanker, being the head of one of the teachers' unions there in New York, right?
Well, initially he was the local UFT, and then he became head of the national AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, which is rivaled by the NEA, the National Educational Association, the bigger of the two teachers' unions.
So, but in looking at this, I mean, over the span of time, because it's always been my premise that, look, I'm a big fan of having neighborhood schools well-funded and parents involved and pushing for as many opportunities for kids as possible. This idea of creating parallel systems or all of these different kinds of things just seem to be, when you don't have the resources to do it, almost impossible.
Well, The contention among the advocates for this kind of freedom and autonomy was that there was too much red tape in the system. And this is especially true and remains true in big cities. There's a great book by a guy named David Rogers, a sociologist, called 110 Livingston Street. Came out back in 1968. David Rogers, a great sociologist and a big fan of public education, sent his three boys to public schools in New York, concluded that the New York City system, 110 Livingston Street, was the name for the headquarters for the New York City Department of Education, or Board of Education, as it was called back then, exemplified what he called bureaucratic pathology. And here's a fan of public education, but he did see a lot of bureaucratic red tape. And you do have advocates of like Albert Shanker on the left, and Deborah Meyer, great progressive educator, who called for more freedom within the system.
Right.
The next step beyond that, though, was this privatization. So Albert Shanker would not approve of what evolved. Deborah Meyer does not approve of what evolved. Deborah Meyer just wanted more autonomy at the school level so that principals could decide on curricula along with teachers and thereby allow parents some choice within the district.
All in favor of that.
And abiding by union membership. So Deborah Meyer was never an enemy of the union. David Rogers wasn't an enemy of the union. What they were an enemy of was a very rigid top-down approach to school administration. And they wanted more freedom. But the next step was this charter school movement. And beyond that, the for-profit management of charter schools, which failed terribly despite Wall Street expectations.
Right. So now we're at this point where I hope, because there are a lot of things that we used to believe, you know, like tax cuts create jobs and all of that stuff, that now we've had a long period of time where we've examined, we've tried some of this stuff, and it hasn't happened. Milton Friedman's ideology just hasn't played out. So where do we go then for people who want to reform education and make sure that we have those, that your local school is nimble enough to offer the curriculum that kids need, and you have some choice and all that within that structure? What's the direction now? What's the latest plan?
Well, that's an excellent way of putting it, Rick, in terms of schools being sufficiently nimble, and they should have that autonomy. Principals need that autonomy. Teachers need that autonomy. The one thing that's really gotten in the way of that kind of autonomy is the rigid testing that's been imposed from Washington, D.C., and it started out at the state level, but by 2001, with the passage of No Child Left Behind, we had a requirement in schools across the country in grades 3 through 8 and 1 year at the high school level for testing in reading and math. Now, that crowds out time for art, music, crafts, as well as history and science. Now, in doing research for this book, Education in the Commercial Mindset, I did learn from teachers in Philadelphia in particular, where I spent a lot of time. I have three chapters in this book on Philadelphia, that they weren't teaching history and science. They were teaching English and math because that is what the students would be tested on for these exams mandated by No Child Left Behind.
Right.
So step number one is we should go to sampling. Since 1968, I have to check that, we've had something called the National Assessment for Educational Progress. More recently, it's an exam given to a sample of fourth graders, eighth graders, and 12th graders in four subjects, reading, math, writing, and science. And it's a statistically significant sample. It's about 2,500 students in each of those grades, fourth, eighth, and 12th. And this is called the National Report Card, and it gives us a great idea of how students are doing. A friend from Finland likes to say, when you go to the doctor and she needs to check your blood, she takes 3 or 4 vials, not 5 liters or a gallon, right? You don't need to look, you don't need to test all these kids. And it's crowded out time for, as I said, art, music, crafts, play, as well as history and science. So in answer to your question, what can we do? Well, let's cut back on all this testing.
I'm with you there. We opted our kids out because, you know, I look at these tests, and I guess I have a question on this. Is it that we're so hung up on absolute numbers? We need data to prove that our kids are doing okay. Or is it really, again, my problem with a lot of things in education today are these big companies who have taken it over, and these tests are so expensive and these tests take up so much of the budget that you know, that's what it really comes down to?
Well, I think there's a complex interplay of factors going on here. You're absolutely right. There's manufactured need. And this goes back forever. Horace Mann, the first Secretary of Education in Massachusetts 150 years ago, said that textbook publishers were manufacturing need by telling you, this is in the 1840s, 1850s, that you need a new edition of the textbook. So you have the same thing going on, as you said, with testing. Okay, you do have testing companies who tell you that you definitely need to test your kids with this new kind of test and do it often, and not just test them at the end of the year, but also do these benchmark assessments every month through the year so you can gauge how well the students are coming along. I would say much of that reflects a certain kind of manufactured need. Again, it's an old story going all the way back to Horace Mann. But second, I think it reflects a very noble ambition to measure the difference between the progress that disadvantaged children are making and the progress that advantaged children are making. And this does comport with the noblest ideals of a democratic republic. The problem is all we've really accomplished with this repeated testing is demonstration of the chasm between disadvantaged and advantaged kids. We really haven't done much more than that. And in the process, we've, as I've said, crowded out time for these other subjects. And we've made school much less pleasant. And school doesn't have to be an amusement park, but you want to make it enticing. You want children to want to go to school. And I've spent a lot of time in the Nordic countries for comparative purposes, and people reflexively dismiss my citation of Finland because it's small, it's egalitarian, and it's homogeneous. Well, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden are also small, egalitarian, and homogeneous. They don't have school systems close in quality to what the Finns have. And one of the reasons why so many people want to become teachers in Finland is because they like school so much themselves as children. And there you have sampling. That friend of mine who talked about sampling, where you go to the doctor and you get 3 or 4 vials of blood taken instead of 5 liters, he's from Finland. And what they do in Finland, in contrast to Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, is they only test 10% of ninth grade. And they're very high-quality exams, and they're in a range of subjects over a 10-year period. We could easily do the same thing.
And we should be. So let me ask you, in moving this towards the political end of this, because most of this is all political, I look at someone like Betsy DeVos. Is she going to take us in a right or a wrong direction?
I think Betsy DeVos will take us very much in the wrong direction. She's not addressing systemic deficiencies. Choice is the panacea. Her means for regulation is her path for regulation is parental choice, that essentially the market will decide. And that's what we've seen in Michigan. Michigan, as far as public education is concerned, is not an exemplar. According to one recent study, they're 47th in reading and math, and that's controlling for demographic differences. So choice, it's an end run, and it's not a successful end run. You get sacked 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. It doesn't work.
No, I mean, I remember because I grew up during the 70s, and in Cleveland, the silver bullet fix back then was taking poor kids out of my neighborhood, putting them on buses, and shipping them halfway across the city to another poor neighborhood that had just as failing and crumbling schools because they didn't invest in them. We spent a lot of money on buses, though. So somebody who built buses did really well during that time period.
Right. And there's another illustration of something very well-intentioned, but in so many ways flawed. And especially because a lot of black children were bused to across town to neighborhoods where they were not well understood. Louisville is a good example of that, Louisville, Kentucky, where they actually, black parents got together and said, enough of this. We don't want this busing to happen because our children are not understood across town. We want our children to go to neighborhood schools. That's a very complex topic, busing.
At the end of it, to me, I'm a big proponent of neighborhood schools, making sure that they're well-funded, that there are opportunities there, and all of that. And what I'm seeing in front of me is very scary stuff for my kids who are in public school and for the future as well.
How old are your children?
I've got a 14-year-old, a 10, and an 8-year-old.
Okay, so you've got the gamut. And we do know what works. And I had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times 2 Sundays ago about things that work, that we know from longitudinal data that really, really work. Heavy investment in early childhood education with college-educated teachers, better pay for teachers, cultivating leadership from within rather than hiring mid-career lawyers, engineers, military officials, military officers to become principals, but bringing up teachers over time. We also know that pay for performance, for example, doesn't work. Merit pay, that's a cardinal objective of business-minded reformers like DeVos. It splits people. And then sampling. Sampling works quite well. We also know from a longitudinal study done in Tennessee from 1985 to 1989, a huge study, it's called the Student-Teacher Achievement Ratio Study, that class size matters. A lot of people like to say class size doesn't matter. Chester Finn, Assistant Secretary of Education under in the Republican era, liked to say the class size didn't matter, but he sent his daughter to Exeter, as Jonathan Kozel pointed out, a private school in New Hampshire that limits class size to about 12. So we know these things work very well. We also know that good teacher training works really well. The University of North Carolina had a wonderful program in place for 25 years that just got killed by a Republican legislature. And it gave a free spot to a student at the University of North Carolina, any of the campuses, who promised to teach within the state for 5 years. Those students who took those spots, and it was, I believe it was 500 a year, they scored a standard deviation higher on the SAT than other students in the UNC system, and they stayed in public education in North Carolina for a long time. So we know it works. These things cost money, but only in the short term, not the long term.
And I say the investment that we don't make today in our kids, we're going to pay for in large amounts in the future when they don't have the earning potential, the tax base that comes from them, and a lot of them end up in prison. It seems simple to me, but again, we do all of these things that just don't seem to make a lot of sense. The book, again, Education and the Commercial Mindset. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com of how you can get Samuel Abrams Brooks. Samuel, I appreciate you taking a little time for us. Thanks for your thoughts.
Okay, enjoy the day.
Great talking with you. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.